Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice on WSCA 106.1 LPFM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today on April 23rd, 2005. Today, we celebrate Earth Day by bringing you the first of our new Making Waves segment by Jeff White, Down to Earth, about environmental matters and appreciation. Our news today will also focus on the environment. Announcements will come to you at the end of our first hour. In the second hour of Making Waves, we'll be bringing you a poem, a talk given at UNH last week about the military draft, and then the latest episode of Between the Lines, independent news and interviews. We'll also have music and another book giveaway during the show, so stay tuned. First, we go to Jeff White with environmental news.
Good afternoon and happy Earth Day. We are focusing today on environmental issues and environmental stories, both in our news segment and in a few of our other pieces. To start the news off, President Bush was scheduled to speak on Earth Day in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. However, Mother Nature obviously wasn't interested in listening to more hot air and created a storm, forcing Bush to miss his photo op in front of the Smoky Mountains. Instead, Bush ended up touting his rhetoric in a National Guard base hangar outside the park, in which he emphasized the importance of personal environmental stewardship, volunteerism, and cooperative conservation efforts. One of the greatest responsibilities in a free society is responsible stewardship of our natural environment, Bush said. However, environmentalists and most other sane people say Bush is not being a responsible steward by pushing for more timber, oil, and gas from public lands and relying on the market rather than regulation to curb pollution. Bush's, quote, healthy forest laws lets companies log large, commercially valuable trees in national forests in exchange for clearing small, more fire-prone trees and brush. His Clear Skies proposal would give power plants, factories, and refineries more time to reduce air pollution. Environmentalists call those labels deliberate misnomers. This story from the Associated Press. As the world marks the 35th anniversary of Earth Day on Friday, environmentalists are debating the future of a movement that seems to be losing the battle for public opinion. While polls show most Americans want clean air, clean water, and wildlife protection, environmental issues rank low on their list of priorities, behind jobs, health care, education, and national security. There's this paradox where Americans hold these views, but when it comes time to take action, there are many, many issues that trump environmental concerns, said Peter Teague, Environmental Programs Director at the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Some think it's a message problem that environmental groups simply need to improve the communication with the voting public. Others are calling for more fundamental changes in how the groups operate. The challenge goes beyond the environmental movement, said George Lakoff, who has written about how language colors political discourse. Lakoff argues that the entire public agenda has been seized by what he calls a right-wing ideological political movement that's extremely powerful and well-funded. The Bush administration's environmental philosophy has centered on the idea that most environmental decisions are better made by the marketplace, landowners, and state and local governments rather than the federal government. In certain proposals that the Bush administration has floated, such as changes to the Clean Air Act, would lead to weaker regulations than required by laws already in place, many environmentalists argue. In the decade after, Senator Gaylord Nelson, Democrat of Wisconsin, started the first Earth Day with a series of teach-ins on April 22, 1970, environmental activists achieved some of their biggest victories. The passage of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act, and Environmental Policy Act. Lately, however, environmental groups have been fighting just to hold on to the gains of the 1970s and 80s, but the battles have not been resonating with the voting public. To win public support, leaders say they are trying to present the problems and potential solutions in language that connects to people's lives. We haven't done a very good job about communicating the solutions, said Kyle Pope, who heads the Sierra Club. Many environmental groups are also finding new allies outside their old political coalitions. The Sierra Club has paired up with ranchers and hunters against increased oil and gas development in some western states. The environmental law firm Earth Justice is working with Hispanic groups and public health advocates to fight air pollution in California's Central Valley, with American Indians to restore salmon runs in the Pacific Northwest, and with Native Hawaiians to protect wildlife in Hawaii. We're building bridges and finding how you can work with other organizations that don't define themselves as environmentalists, said Earth Justice's Peter Parker. This from the National Geographic News. The longer an animal or plant species is protected under the U.S. Endangered Species Act, the more likely it is to recover, a new study says. The finding contradicts recent criticism that the act has returned too few species to full health. Researchers compared population trends of 1,095 listed species with three related factors: how long the species were listed, whether their habitat had been protected, and whether specific recovery plans were in place. Overall, the study found that the Endangered Species Act is effective, said scientists from the Center for Biological Diversity in Tucson, Arizona. Scientists were able to identify three aspects that contribute to the act's success: recovery plans, critical habitat, and the listing itself. However, not everyone agrees that the Endangered Species Act successfully preserves and protects wildlife. Critics argue that recovery of only 15 animals in 32 years indicates failure. Scientists counter that the statistic is not a good measure of the act's effectiveness. That would be like walking into an emergency room and saying, "Look, everyone is sick. This hospital must be a failure." A better measure, they say, is the extent to which the ESA, Endangered Species Act, is moving species toward recovery. In particular, species that have had dedicated recovery plans in effect for two or more years showed greater rates of survival and recovery. Recovery plans lay out specific steps that need to be carried out to restore species to health. Protecting critical habitat, areas that have biological or physical features essential to conservation, was also found to assist survival and recovery efforts. Such habitats, though, have rarely been designated since 1986, when new regulations restricted the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's ability to establish critical habitats. Regulations introduced by the Reagan administration created a feeling that protection of habitat was a redundant, unnecessary, and expensive procedure. In the last 4 or 5 years, however, courts have repeatedly struck down the 1986 regulations. Recently, more than 350 new critical habitats have been designated, the researchers wrote. Our results suggest that if this progress continues, the proportion of species with recovering trends will increase significantly. And this story by the Natural Resources Defense Council. On the eve of the world's largest furniture show in High Point, North Carolina, two national conservation groups called on leading U.S. furniture manufacturers to stop using imported Peruvian mahogany in their products. The groups, the Natural Resource Defense Council and Defenders of Wildlife, say nearly all of Peru's big leaf mahogany exports are logged illegally, and that 80% of the contraband harvest ends up in the United States. Top name companies that have acknowledged using South American mahogany include Stickley, Furniture Brands International, who are the makers of Broyhill, Drexel Heritage, Henrydin, and Thomasville. Other companies contacted by the groups, including Williams Sonoma, owner of the Pottery Barn, said they were unaware of the source of their mahogany. Peru's inability to control mahogany logging makes it impossible for U.S. companies to know if they are buying illegal lumber, the groups say. The unsustainable logging is having devastating effects on indigenous Amazon communities, wildlife, and the survival of the mahogany species itself. The exports violate a major treaty, which is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, also known as CITES. This week, the National Resource Defense Council and Defenders of Wildlife sent letters to CEOs of major U.S. furniture manufacturers asking them to avoid buying Peruvian mahogany until the illegal logging is stopped. Illegal logging has been a major problem in Peru for many years, but it has accelerated after Brazil cracked down on similar activities in its rainforest. In late March, Parks Watch, a nonprofit organization associated with Duke University, released a report that found the Peruvian government is not enforcing national forestry laws and logging bans, and that there is widespread illegal logging in supposedly protected areas and in major national parks and on other lands where indigenous people live. Peruvian timber companies are mixing legally and illegally logged wood for export, and gun-toting loggers are killing indigenous people trying to defend their land with bows and arrows. The groups say the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service continues to accept invalid export permits for Peruvian mahogany despite clear evidence the Peruvian government is violating the CITES Treaty rules requiring proof that logs are harvested legally and sustainably. This wood is illegal as a matter of both U.S. in international law. It is illegal to trade in it, to import it and to possess it. Even so, the Bush administration has done nothing to stop Peruvian mahogany from entering the country, said Carol Muffet, director of Defenders of Wildlife International Program. We're asking companies to do what the president won't, take real action to end illegal logging. And this story from the Associated Press, Mikhail Gorbachev is pressing world leaders to adopt a treaty guaranteeing clean water and sanitation for their people, a task he says is more daunting than ending the nuclear arms race during the Cold War. Dwindling water supplies and political resistance have hampered efforts to bring fresh water to poor people around the world, the former Soviet leader said. We were able to solve the nuclear arms race because of political will, he said before an awards banquet held by his American environmental group, Global Green USA. Today we don't see that political will, but I think it will emerge that leaders will have to address this problem. Gorbachev called for a first-ever international water treaty during an April 21st keynote address to the UN Commission on Sustainable Development. He envisions a binding agreement that makes access to water and basic sanitation a human right, holds nations responsible for providing it, and governs how freshwater resources are managed and shared. Gorbachev, a Nobel Peace Prize laureate who led the Soviet Union for 6 years until its 1991 collapse, founded Green Cross International in 1993 to encourage business, government, and non-governmental organizations to collaborate and find solutions to environmental problems. A former Soviet agriculture official, Gorbachev said he saw firsthand the effects of drought on harvest and of mismanaging water supplies on the environment. In recent years, he has urged groups to give people access to clean water and sanitation. Wealthy countries, he argued, should devote more funding to solving the problem. It's scandalous that a lot of this money is not found and put into saving the kids who die every day from unsafe water, he said. About 2.5 billion people worldwide lack water sanitation services, and 5 million die from waterborne diseases each year, according to the Global Green USA, the American arm of the Green Cross. Nearly 1.2 billion people do not have clean water to drink. And in our final story, the House celebrated Earth Day by approving a far-ranging energy bill Thursday that would open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling and shield makers of controversial gasoline additives from environmental lawsuits. The bill would also funnel more than $12 billion in tax breaks and subsidies to energy companies. Opponents of the legislation said it would do little to foster less energy use. A proposal to require higher fuel economy for cars was rejected. Most Democrats denounced the bill as a giveaway to energy industries. It is clearly designed to help energy companies make more money, not help the American people save money, said Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi of California. House Republican leaders had tried to prevent a floor vote on the fuel additive MTBE. Democrats said GOP leaders want to shield not only MTBE manufacturers from lawsuits, but also lawmakers from having to vote on a matter involving drinking water contamination in communities in their districts. Democrats forced a vote, arguing that the MTBE provision violates a 1995 law because it would saddle states and municipalities with huge expenses. Representative Lois Capps, Democrat of California, said groundwater contamination from the additive has affected more than 1,800 community water systems in 29 states with a potential cleanup cost of $29 billion. Her amendment to remove the provision failed 219-213. The House bill would shield MTBE manufacturers, including large oil companies, from lawsuits claiming the companies knew all along it would cause water contamination. At least 80 lawsuits involving MTBE have been filed. Democrats also tried to eliminate a provision allowing oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, but failed by a vote of 231-200. Critics of the proposal said the oil won't be available for a decade, and then will not be enough to significantly affect either prices or the need for large amounts of oil. And that is it. Happy Earth Day, folks. Go out and plant a tree, not a bush.
If the earth could fly away, could you see her flying straight through space and time, leaving all humankind behind? If she could fly away, if she could fly away, so far away. If the earth could run away? Could you see her gathering all the trees and plants, all the animals, all the birds and fowl, every creeping thing? They have never been her foe, never harmed her blessed soul. If she could run away, if she could run away, so far away, then she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for her blessed life. Oh, she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for her blessed life. If the earth could up and walk away, could you see her calling for all the oceans and the seas, all the rivers and the streams, all the whales and fish, every reptile that exists? They have never been her foe, never harmed her blessed soul. If she could walk away, if she could walk away, so far away, then she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for her blessed life. Oh, she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for her blessed life. Earth could crawl away, could you see her moving on with a body withered down? She'd be struggling to be free, free from cruel humanity. If she could crawl away, if she could get away, so far away, then she'd be struggling for life. Oh, she'd be struggling for life, struggling for her blessed life. Oh, she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for her blessed life. Oh, she'd be running, running, running.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Battered Earth. We now go to the first of our new segment, Down to Earth, with Jeff White. In this segment, Jeff is going to be exploring environmental matters and appreciation of the environment. In his first episode, Jeff is going to be speaking with a woman at a nearby CSA, Community Supported Agriculture Farm. Given the time of year and the planting starting, we thought this would be a great moment to introduce you to this concept.
What is a CSA exactly? I know it stands for Community Supported Agriculture, but if you could tell us a little bit about what a CSA is and why it's important.
Basically, it's an arrangement between a farm and the community around the farm, and that community is sometimes very close by and sometimes it's further away, but they're all people who have agreed to support this farm in advance of the season, usually. So usually the arrangement is somebody signs on as a shareholder and pays in the winter or spring for the share of the harvest that they'll be receiving during the season, usually from June to October around here. you know, it's all about really connecting people to their local farm and really giving the farmer that support in advance.
So it helps to keep the farm afloat better. It's a little more predictable as far as that you know the crops will be sold and that you know that you'll have some guaranteed
right.
way to get things
yeah.
going.
Yeah, we've done farmers markets in the past, and with CSA, there's a lot less waste. You know exactly that you're going to grow for 200 shareholders and you grow that much lettuce or broccoli or beans or peas, and when you sort of plan for 200 shares, and then if it's a really good year for the peas and the yield is very high, then you go out and you pick everything that you can and you divide it by 200 shares, and people might get more than you had planned for. And so that's one of the benefits of being a shareholder sometimes. There are also some risks, or you know, shareholders sort of share in the risks and the rewards of the farming right. year, so that they would get more peas if it was a bountiful season for that, and then maybe if the onions didn't do so well, they might not get as many of those.
Mm-hmm.
But we plant so many different types of crops that usually it evens itself out oh. over the course of time. And it is, it's for the farmer, it's kind of a nice way of planning for things. You do end up growing maybe more things than you would if you were specializing in a certain crop for sale at a market or whatever. But we really enjoy growing things that way for our shareholders.
That sounds like a good way to go, and really gets the community grounded, so to speak, down to earth.
The way it used to be is when you had a catastrophe with a crop, you would suffer that loss on your
right.
own. And these days, farms could go out of business very quickly if they didn't have more support from the community to say, well, you know, it's okay that the onions didn't do so well. We're still going to support you anyway. We're still going to give you that full share payment, and we know that we'll get more peas. It's nice to help the farmer through those hard times, knowing that there will be better times ahead. And it keeps the farmers each year is a little more predictable from year to year to year. And I think especially with the price of farmland the way it is and the costs of staying in business, it's really nice to have that kind of commitment from your shareholders. It gives you a sense that you will be able to keep going.
Could you mention, you just spoke a little bit about the diversity of crops that you grow. Can you talk about that versus the traditional industrial model? As you mentioned, I always think of course the Irish potato famine. But there's a lot of examples of that where somebody grows, specializes in one or two or you know, three and a half dozen things, and then something doesn't go right or some kind of insect or disease comes in and wipes out their crops.
Well, we grow this diverse number of crops. It's quite a game of planning and
yeah.
testing the soil and really listening to the needs of your farm.
You plant broccoli one year, then you plant something else that's going to use other nutrients another year.
We do a lot of rotating of our crops here, but you know, we're still working on opening up enough space that we can do as much cover cropping and rotation as we'd like to. But that is the plan, to be able to rest uh-huh. some areas.
How many acres do you have here?
Maybe about 6 or 7 acres this year. We started with just 1.5, and we've been adding open ground a little bit at a time.
And that's enough to support 200 families?
Six or 7 acres will for us this year support 200 shareholders, which sometimes is more than 200 families if some people share a share.
Right.
But at least 200 families. Yeah.
So it's quite a few people.
Yeah, depending on how people eat. I think a lot of people do just get their share and they don't go to the store and buy other things
right.
to go with it. And then other people, you know, want to add different things. Mm-hmm. They go to the farmer's market or they have their own home gardens and they grow extra tomatoes or whatever it is that they want to have.
And obviously tropical fruits if they want that.
Right.
As we see in the supermarket, there are fruits and vegetables from all over the country, in all over the world actually. It always amazes me to see where our fruit comes from, Chile, Argentina. And I know a lot of those places don't really have much in the way of regulations on chemical use on the plants, not to mention the labor laws and things of that nature. It seems like pretty much trashing their land with chemicals and causing a lot of erosion. And I know that happens in the United States too, but obviously we have, at least till now, we have more environmental protection in some ways than a lot of these countries.
Right.
Could you mention some of the benefits as far as buying local versus just going
sure.
to Shaw's or Hannaford or any of these big
sure.
chain supermarkets?
Well, especially around here, I think a local farm almost always means a relatively small farm where the farm owners are pretty directly running the farm and managing things. And I think that when the farm owners or the farm managers are the ones who have to be out there really, you know, if there is a pest issue and you're going to spray a pesticide, if they're the ones doing it, they're going to say, do I want to be, you know, using this sort of thing? And so I think that when the farm is owned by a family and run on a very small scale like that, they're making choices that affect them and and their land that they'd like to pass on to their family and be around for generations. And you know, they care about their land most of the time.
Like you said, some people grow tomatoes in their house to supplement what they get here, so they probably learn things that you do here. And I know that's one of my...
Yeah, we do a lot of volunteer events, and we're going to try to do workshops about canning and freezing and root cellaring to really, I think people have, to a great extent, lost the art of feeding themselves year-round. In this region, you know, 60 years ago, or you know, maybe a little bit longer ago, we were all eating locally and seasonally, and it was very common, and people knew how to do it, and we've sort of lost some of those skills in the past few years, and so we're going to attempt to do some workshops to train people, because then I think they'll be better shareholders. They'll know how to use all these different foods that we're giving them, and know how to, you know, eat some of them now while they're fresh and green, and put some of them away for later in the winter to be able to eat 12 months out of the year from our farm.
Exactly, because that's probably one of the main issues. I know I lived in, main issues, no pun intended, but I lived in Oregon for a while, and you can pretty much grow stuff year-round there, because it's obviously doesn't, you don't get the frost. But in New England, when I moved back here, realizing that I wanted to do some of my own agriculture, the challenges are obviously different. And, you know, as far as alternative technology and building, same thing, it just gets a lot colder here. You had mentioned doing a few workshops on root cellars. Is that what you said?
Root cellaring and canning and freezing and drying.
So those would be the methods that you would use in the months that you aren't growing things, so people could have some vegetables anyway during the winter.
Right, especially in the fall. Occasionally we offer winter shares, root crops like carrots and beets and potatoes and also onions, garlic, even some hardy greens that we've managed to keep alive in the field until November or something like that. And the idea behind those shares is people will come and pick up a box and bring it home and store it properly in their basement for during the course of a month or whatever. And so if we can teach more people how to, you know, even go to the farmer's market and buy all the carrots that you think you would eat during the winter and pack them away in wet sand or wood shavings or something with a little bit of air flowing through and keep them damp throughout the winter. We're still eating carrots out of our root cellar, and it's April, you know, and we put those in there.
From last year.
We put them in the root cellar in late October. So we do a lot of canning ourselves of things like tomatoes and things that you can't just store in the root cellar.
Well, question about what we're looking at here. We're standing outside right now. And I don't know if people can hear the wind or the birds in the background, but it's a bit of a cool day, like 50 degrees, and we're standing in front of some crops that basically are sitting on pallets.
We've got these cold frames set up.
Cold frames, yeah.
Most of these things are onions, leeks, shallots, scallions that have been started in the greenhouse, and it'll be time for them to go in the ground the end of this week, beginning of next week, and we're hardening them off in these cold frames where they get to sit out in the wind and sun during the day, and we cover them up with some plastic at night. There are also some different brassicas there, some early, amongst some kohlrabi and some Asian greens. That's about it out here right now. We've got some other broccoli and herbs and lettuces still inside the greenhouse right now. So in the next week or so, we'll start putting a lot of things in the ground, because even though it's still cold at night a little bit, many of these things are hardy, and we'll keep them covered with some row covers in the field to keep the heavy frosts off them. But at least we'll get a head start, so that when those first weeks of the shares come in June, we'll have a wide variety of things for people, even though it's very early in the season.
Mm-hmm. So you typically start planting, at least the early spring stuff would go into the ground in late April, early May?
Yeah, depending on the weather, we might put things in as early as the end of March, but it's pretty unusual to have all the snow melted and all the fields dry enough. We wash the vegetables right outside this barn door, and then things come in and sort of sit on pallets to drain a little bit before we put them in the walk-in cooler. And, you know, we'll store things there. Even though we pick most of the items that the shareholders receive the morning of the pickup, it's still nice to have the cold storage for that day and also for the things that you have to harvest every day, like cucumbers and zucchini. And so, you know, we'll store some things in the walk-in, and then this is the CSA distribution room where we set up tables and baskets and signs, and when somebody comes in the front doors of the barn there, they'll see a sign that says, you know, this week's share, take one head of lettuce, one bunch of radishes, half a pound of arugula, whatever it is that's available that week. There's a sign next to each item telling them how much to take. And this is a nice gathering space for shareholders. You know, people get to meet each other inside the barn, and there's a space outside where we grow some flowers for pick your own, and so people can go out and do a little picking of herbs and flowers and meet with other shareholders, and the kids are always running around and playing. And we also have in the corner of the barn a little shareholder store where people can buy frozen meats and also things like eggs and cheese and syrup. We try to focus on getting different local organic products that we don't grow or raise ourselves, and making those things available to shareholders to purchase in addition to their vegetables. So it's kind of nice. You can come and get more than just vegetables at the farm.
How long have you guys been doing this?
This is our fifth season. We've been doing CSA. This will be our fourth season of the CSA. So we started out just doing some farmers markets and restaurant sales, and we've been gradually growing the CSA. We started at about 25 shares in 2002, and then increased to 75, and then 130, and this year we're at 200. And we imagine we'll probably be 250 or 300 before we've really grown to the right size to support the farm.
But so it's a process over a few years.
Yeah, for us it has been. Some people could just jump in and start doing it. Last year was the first year that we didn't also do a farmer's market in addition to the CSA. So now we're sort of more of an official CSA where that's what we focus on, and our shareholders are truly supporting the farm. I think it's taken us about 4 years to really get our marketing in place so that people know that we're here, and we're still, you know, working on even getting folks right in town to know what we do, because it's sort of unusual. We don't have a farm stand. People can't just come in and buy whatever they want, so it's a little bit harder to explain.
Is that the most challenging part of it, the marketing? That's what I've heard that.
It's been one very challenging part, but I think we've handled it pretty well, and we, you know, the types of things that we've done have definitely helped us attract people who are interested, and it seems like now we've been around long enough that word of mouth is our best way of spreading the word. You know, people who were those early shareholders mention it to their friends, and, you know, it just sort of goes on like that, and so we've had to work less and less hard because we've got a lot of people out there working for us telling people about it. But it is, it's something that it seems like an ideal arrangement for a farmer, but I think as a farmer you have to be very interested in working with the public and talking to people, and really not just the marketing piece, but throughout the season there's a lot of interaction with the shareholders, and if you're not a people person, it's probably not the best arrangement.
Exactly.
But we really want people to come to our farm and treat it like their farm, and walk around, see the crops growing, and take a swim in the river and ask a lot of questions, and, you know, see how things are going. And so we really wanted to be a farm where people could come and, you know, experience what goes on.
Right. So it's a real community focal point. You know, people come here and hang out and learn and connect with each other.
That's
and
right.
So,
hi, Rachel.
Hi.
That's all right.
That's all right.
This is Rachel. She's our farm manager.
Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
Good to meet you.
Hi.
Coming in to get the tractor?
Yeah.
Nice.
It's quite a contraption.
It's a speedy little thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that tractor probably was built in the 1950s or so.
Yeah,
and during a time when people weren't using chemical herbicides for weeding their crops, and so it's a great tractor for us because you put little basket weeders on it, mm-hmm. and you drive over the crop and get rid of all the little weeds, and you just do it on a regular basis, and we use some petroleum to run the tractor, but we don't have to use a lot of chemicals right. to keep the weeds down, so we like it.
That's great. So how can people get involved or reach you? I understand you guys still have some shares left for this coming season.
That's right. We do have some shares available. And probably the best way for people to get a little more information about our farm and what we do and to, you know, see if it's a good fit for them is to go to our website. And mm-hmm. our farm is called Wolf Pine Farm. And so you go to wolfpinefarm.com.
Okay.
And it has all of our contact information there. We usually encourage people to give us a call and, you know, ask any additional questions that they might have and tell us that they're sending their application in, because we can let you know if there are still shares available mm-hmm. as of that day, because it is getting close to the end, and you know, we imagine they'll be filled by sometime in May.
So, all right. Yeah. Well, thank you, Amy Sprague. This is Jeff White with Making Waves on Down to Earth, and thank you for taking time out, and good luck in Portland. You're going up to Portland for the Earth Day stuff?
Yeah, we're doing that tomorrow, and yep. we've got a lot of different meetings in the next few days related to Earth Day, mm-hmm. so it's going to be a nice time.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Take care.
This neighborhood is blighted, that's what people say. Half the buildings are abandoned, everything is gray. Half the kids have asthma because of the sewage plants nearby. And the mayor doesn't seem to care if we live or die. That's the situation. Now let me take you to the part, the center of this neighborhood, what you could call the heart, a vacant lot of broken glass. For years that's what it's been, but the neighbors got together, said this is where we will begin. We'll dig this dirt, plant a seed, push aside the concrete so the earth beneath is free. We'll plant a garden, grow some food to eat, and the sunflowers looking to the sky say we reclaim this street. In one day we had accomplished what the mayor always said he was trying to bring us, threw his clubs upon our heads. The neighborhood is clean, the dealer's gone away, we had good food to eat, place for the kids to play. We'll dig this dirt, plant a seed, push aside the concrete so the earth beneath is free. We'll plant a garden, grow some food to eat, and the sunflowers looking to the sky say we reclaim this street. This is not our land. Twice the cops destroyed it, all the work of our own hands. Uprooted plants and broken tools lay scattered all around. But the next day the only thing you could see was fingers in the ground. We'll dig this dirt, plant a seed, push aside the concrete so the earth beneath is free. We'll plant a garden, grow some food to eat, and the sunflowers looking to the sky say we reclaim this street. We reclaim this street.
We just heard Nancy Griffith with Trouble in the Fields, followed by David Rovix with More Gardens. I hope that you have on your calendar already to come on May 3rd to the Amy Goodman talk. She'll be in Portsmouth at the UU Church at 7 p.m. that evening. David Rovix will also be coming and doing a few songs for us. In anticipation of this really exciting evening, Seacoast Peace Response has donated to us Amy's new book, which is what the tour is celebrating. It is called Exception to the Rulers, and we want to give it away to you. If you email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com, and you're the fifth person to send us your address and your interest in getting it, we'll send it out to you. Thanks to Seacoast Peace Response for the donation and to you for listening. This past week, our neighbors to the north in Maine held a public hearing on CAFTA, the proposed Central American Free Trade Agreement. Here's a report back on what happened there. The Maine Citizen Trade Policy Commission held another outstanding public hearing on CAFTA and other international trade issues this past Tuesday, April 19th, in Portland, Maine. More than 75 people turned out for the three-hour hearing and offered an impressive array of testimony on the negative impacts of the current corporate trade model. Speakers spoke knowledgeably and eloquently, delivering substantive testimony on a wide range of trade-related topics. From personal accounts of the devastating impacts of job loss and deindustrialization in Maine communities to the thoughtful critiques of the relationship between militarism and corporate globalization to concerns about the impacts of trade rules on zoning and development regulations, water services, gambling regulations, and the basics of our democracy and public services, speakers made a powerful and compelling case that CAFTA should be opposed and that the current corporate model of trade policy and globalization should be radically revised. Democracy and people's concerns need to be put at the center of the rules that govern trade and the global economy. In all, some 30 people weighed in with their comments, questions, concerns, and recommendations, and more testifiers were waiting in the wings, but were not able to speak as the hearing had to end by 10 p.m. There was not a single testifier who spoke in favor of CAFTA. Speakers made a number of formal requests of the Citizen Trade Policy Commission, including numerous requests that the Commission formally recommend to Maine's congressional delegation that they oppose CAFTA. Representatives from all four members of Maine's congressional delegation were on hand. Together with the Commission's first public hearing in Bangor, the message from Maine and to Maine's congressional delegation was overwhelmingly clear. No to CAFTA and other unfair corporate trade deals, and yes to fair trade, democracy, and a just global economy that respects working people, the environment, family farmers, women, and public health. These hearings have been a very powerful example of citizen democracy in action, and they have also played a key role in reframing the debate about trade and globalization. Numerous speakers at both hearings made it very clear that the debate was not about whether one was for or against trade or globalization. Rather, the real debate was fundamentally about what kind of rules govern trade and globalization, who gets to set those rules, and who wins and who loses as a result. It is a debate about what kind of trade agreements and what kind of global economy we are going to have and who trade and the global economy should work for. The Commission staff will be putting together a summary of people's testimony, and we will be working to put up copies of the testimony on the Maine Fair Trade Campaign website in the coming week. This information will be shared as soon as it is available. This report was put together by Matt Schlobum of the Maine Fair Trade Campaign. Their website is www.pica.ws/MFTC. We now go to Steve Diamond, who will read our announcements live today. If you're listening online, you won't be hearing this, but you can go to www.seacoastpeaceresponse.org to find out these calendar announcements.